Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
My name is Argon Mikael Mehmet Giovanni Janer. I am the son of Adjar Mehmet Janer. I was raised for the first 17 years of my life as a Sunni Muslim. Adjar Mehmet Janer, my father, was a muazzin. He was an ulema. Muazzin is the one who does the call to prayer in the minaret. An ulema is a scholar of the hadith. I was raised in the mosque and raised and brought here to America to be a missionary to you.
Well, it sounds awful familiar, but a new video has appeared with some new information that once again casts very serious doubt upon the excuses that have been posted by Dr. Norman Geisler and haven't received any updates for a number of months now. In fact, the Geisler camp, the Ankerberg camp, have gone absolutely positively silent in regards to the refutations of their material and the questions that have been asked of them. And yet the great evangelical cover-up continues on. What you just heard was a number of things. First of all, another example of where Ergun Canner exaggerated his father's scholarship, where he likewise, instead of calling him an alim, which is a scholar, said he was an ulema. Ulema is the plural, so he said he was a scholars, and identified him as a scholars of hadith. Now, the hadith, of course, are one of those things that have tripped up Ergun and Emir Canner, because in their book Unveiling Islam, in the majority of references, they forget to cite the hadith in a meaningful fashion. And that is one of the questions that continues to be unanswered by Dr. Norman Geisler. I have asked him to please identify, using the methodology utilized by the Canners in citing the hadith literature, to identify hadith 2425 and to tell us why that is an important hadith relating to the Quran. Of course, Dr. Geisler can't do that, which is why he hasn't answered and will not answer and will not even deem it proper or appropriate to answer, because he's been caught. He has been exposed, and he knows it, and there's nothing he can do about it without admitting that his defense of Ergun Canner is fallacious, and he's simply not going to do that, unfortunately. And so there you just heard the assertion that an ulema, which it means scholars, is a scholar of hadith. Well, the ulema as a whole, Muslim scholars, certainly in Sunni Islam, study the hadith, the various collections of hadith, such as Sahih al-Bukhari, Sahih al-Muslim, Jami'at Tirmidhi, etc., etc. They are more than that. They, first of all, have to be scholars of the Quran, first and foremost, to really qualify in that way. Then, later on, he goes on to make the following statements in this video.
The Quran is one big monologue. It's supposedly one long utterance from Allah.
Let me just stop it there for just a moment. That's just not true. I mean, if you've read the Quran, you know better. I mean, they do believe that Allah sent it down to Muhammad to be recited, but there are citations of Lucifer in the Quran, and of other people. It's right there. If you've actually read it yourself, you are aware of those things.
But the hadith is different. Any Muslim who's worth his salt knows what the hadith is.
Which would evidently mean that Ergun Canner is not a Muslim worth his salt, because he doesn't know the difference between Sahih al-Bukhari, Sahih al-Muslim, Jami'at Tirmidhi, Sunan Abu Dawud, and stuff like that, which, you know, you would... I mean, talk about hanging yourself on your own petard, you know? There you go. But anyway.
There are actually scholars called Ahadith who spend their lives studying this Muslim version or Muslim counterpart to the Jewish Talmud.
Actually, Ahadith is simply the plural of Hadith. So what he just said is that there are Muslim scholars called Hadiths who study the Hadith. It's mu is the term that you would use. Muhadith would be the studiers, the scholars of the Hadith. How can you expect someone who clearly has spent almost no time whatsoever with the Hadith to know anything about the Hadith, or to know that Ahadith is actually just the plural, when you don't know that ulema is the plural of alim? So that sort of makes some sense. What makes all this so sad, aside from the great evangelical cover-up being headed up by Norman Geisler, and the fact that it's working, is this. You'll notice that folks like John Ankerberg have not responded to the refutation of their endorsements of Ergen Kantor, and I think we know why. Listen to these words from John Ankerberg.
All right, back. We're talking about the truth about Islam and jihad with renowned scholar Dr. Emir Kantor, who's probably, with his brother, the world's foremost scholars on Islam and comparing it with Christianity.
World's foremost scholars on Islam. Now, remember, I got attacked a number of months ago because I pointed out that they're making claims about themselves. Oh, they're just students. They don't. And there, Emir Kantor sits. Now I understand. I'll give him a break. I've had people say things while interviewing me that I was just going, where in the world did they get that? And if I can, I try to correct any misapprehensions. But there's another quote from another, I think it was a Jewish program where they were talking with Ergen Kantor and said, you know, he's the one to go to. And the sad thing is, folks, they might get away with continuing to represent themselves in this way. This is a small podcast. Ours is a relatively small voice. And though I know in talking with people in the apologetics community, the word's gotten out there. But unfortunately, when it comes to the big conferences and stuff like that, that's still very, very dominated by politics. And I'm not a politician, and I'm not interested in playing politics. I won't play politics. But there are people who are consummate politicians and who have a tremendous amount of authority when it comes to politics and hence to money. And if they have chosen to engage in the cover-up like Norman Geisler has, well, they may succeed. They may succeed. Would it really surprise anybody looking at the state of affairs in evangelicalism in the United States that someone would get away with this? It doesn't surprise me at all. And it doesn't discourage me in the sense that this has happened down through the history of the church, and there is a day coming when the truth will be known and the motivations that people had will be laid out on the table. And the politics will be exposed, and the money will be exposed, and justice and righteousness will prevail. And that's my hope. And so I just keep doing what I can do and what seems to be best, and move on from there, such as tomorrow evening engaging Abdullah Kunda in a debate on ABN. That's abnsat.com. 5 o'clock my time, 8 o'clock Eastern time. Very important subject, one that I'll be perfectly honest with you, I'm glad Ergen Kantor is not doing debates on and has never done debates on, and that is Christianity and Islam, assurance of salvation in both. How do you have assurance of salvation as a Muslim in comparison to how a Christian has assurance of salvation? Very, very important topic. We'll be on live. It will be a video debate. And you shouldn't be overly surprised to see the video that will be coming from my office is the same video that you see on my videos on YouTube. And I just wonder if Abdullah Kunda will make any comment about my green lava lamp. That is the question. Will there be any commentary on the green lava lamp? In the fact, Abdullah's a young guy. He may not even know what it is. He may go, wow, that's pretty cool. Yeah, you weren't around the 70s, were you? So anyway, that'll be tomorrow night, 8 o'clock Eastern time. 5 o'clock my time, which is currently Pacific Daylight Time, which is actually Mountain Standard Time, blah, 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 blah. In fact, we need to be looking for when's that switch over? Is that next month, October? Somewhere around there. Yeah, well, we got to find out because then everybody goes and plays their clocks, and so we got to play with ours and all that kind of stuff.
No, we don't need to find out. It's everybody else that
needs
to
we
find
do
out
because I have.
We don't change.
I know we don't change, but we still have to interface with everybody who does. And not only that,
interface with us.
And I've got atomic clocks, and not all of them have the daylight savings time turn-off switch. It's just a pain. Anyway, one more thing before we go to our calls. about 2 weeks ago or so, maybe a little bit more. Thank you, LU. Just told me Abdullah Kunda surely watched Scooby-Doo. Well, I don't know if he did or not. He is in Australia. I'm not sure how big Scooby-Doo was in Australia, but maybe it got down there. I don't know. About two and a half, 3 weeks. I forget how long ago it was now. I'm looking forward to doing this ride again. Once it stinking cools down out here, which it is not doing right now, it's going to be back up to 103 on Saturday. But I did a ride out to Dynamite Road. Anybody who lives in the area goes up northeast. Dynamite Road goes way out into the middle of nowhere out toward the Superstition Mountains. And it's a big climb up, then a big, huge 9-mile hill down, and then you have to turn around and climb back up the hill you just climbed up. That's how it works. And I was listening to a bunch of unbelievable radio programs. And, oh, Justin, I'm sorry. Justin sent me a promo audio I was going to play, and I'll be happy to play Justin's promo audio if I remember to transfer it over this computer. Sorry, Justin, my apologies, but I will play Justin's promo audio for Unbelievable. I do enjoy listening to the program. But I was listening to a bunch of Justin audios to a bunch of Unbelievable programs while I was riding on that ride, and I was listening to the follow-up program they did to when Cy was on and talked about presuppositionalism. And they had some definitely non-presuppositionalists on with an atheist, the same atheist that Cy had been on with. And these are all people that have participated in the online forums at the Premier Christian Radio Network and the Unbelievable online forums that you can get onto and stuff like that. And it was somewhat interesting to listen to until I got to this one point. And this is a Christian speaking. I don't even remember who they were. I'm not trying to pick on this one particular person, but this was just such a bad example of this just grossly unbiblical view of the gospel. I had to comment on it. I determined I was going to do that as I was coming back down that hill, and I just haven't done it, and I just need to. I feel it's absolutely necessary to do this. Here, there is an atheist in the channel, or I'm not sorry, in the studio, and this guy's already given him his Bible, which is very nice. But the problem is, when Cy had talked with this atheist, this is the very atheist that Cy Brueggenkate had gotten to start abandoning the need for logic and rationality. I mean, he had done a good job getting him to say, well, you know, I just don't think we need to be quite that rational, you know? And it's pretty rare to have the atheist, you know, doing that. But now you got guys who aren't going Cy's direction, you know, and they're just talking about emotions and feelings and getting together with people and all the rest of this stuff. I never heard a call for repentance. I never heard the absolute lordship of Christ proclaimed with clarity. It was troubling on that level. But this section just about made me crash, okay? I was coming back down Dynamite, so I was about 25, 26 miles an hour. And when I heard this, I'm certain that I was making discernible guttural sounds, even as I was riding by. You just have to listen, and you'll see. Here's part of the discussion on the Unbelievable Radio broadcast.
I think we are so self-sufficient that when you finally rise to the dignity of despair, and I think God will put you through a desert, and if you just check in your pride, and you do what the Bible asks, which is, you know, Jesus, I don't believe in you, but if you're there, come into my life. He promises that he will answer. That's a promise from God. And so if you want evidence, go try that.
Did you hear that? I rolled it back and I listened to it again. With all the respect I can muster in my heart to this man who calls himself a Christian, my friend, that is not the gospel in any way, shape, or form. And may I say to the atheist to whom this was said, please, sir, do not be confused. That is not the gospel. Jesus is not a self-help methodology. Jesus is not a whitening paste that you put on your teeth. Try it for a month, and if it doesn't work, I'll give you your money back. You don't try Jesus. There is nothing about repentance there. And in fact, what you just heard was, say to Jesus, I don't believe in you, but do something for me anyways, and that'll give you your evidence. Be an unbeliever, no repentance, no faith, but Jesus will do something for you anyways. I'm sorry, that is so far from anything that any apostle of the Lord Jesus Christ ever stated, ever said, ever wrote, ever taught, ever preached, that it amazes me someone didn't just jump out of their chair and say, what? What did you just say? Did you just tell an unbeliever to remain an unbeliever, but to see if Jesus would, like, do something for him? You know, heal his back, make his shorter leg as long as his longer leg, you know, make his hair start growing back on his bald head, something. But you don't have to believe in Jesus, but Jesus will do something for you, and that'll give you your evidence. I'm sorry. That is so far removed from the gospel that I'm left stuttering. If I had been in the studio, even if it had been the last time I was in the studio, I would have had to say, excuse me, but that is not the gospel. The gospel does not say, be an unbeliever, and then Jesus will do something for you if you'll just sort of maybe nod his direction. The thing that was so, that concerned me so much about almost everything that was said to that atheist. And see, since he had been on with the presuppositionalists, this was sort of like, well, let us get our shot. Tsai challenged this man's autonomy. He challenged him to recognize that God is God and he isn't. And these guys didn't. At least this guy didn't. It was all about allowing the unbeliever to remain an unbeliever and to judge God. And that was, I think, a real, real eye-opening contrast between a biblical apologetic, which says you speak the truth in love. You tell the man you are the creature of God. God created you. God made you. And you have responsibilities before your creator. Now, the rebel sinner doesn't like that. But you see, if you're dependent upon the rebel sinner liking your methodology and liking your message, you're never going to see anybody saved. Because the reality is, it's only the Spirit of God that brings spiritual life. And the message of the gospel is supposed to be offensive to the rebel sinner, not something that makes him feel warm and fuzzy. And so when I heard that, I was absolutely, positively blown away by what was said and by the assertion that, you know, Jesus, I don't believe in you, but what? That's not the gospel, folks. Don't get confused. Don't be confused. That is not the gospel. Three? Oh, yes, I understand. So with that, let's go to our phone calls. And in fact, so this is a regular phone call, not a Skype phone call? Regular phone call. Okay, all right. So we're gonna go across the pond here and into Europe, and we are going to talk with Peter in Peter auf Deutschland. Guten Tag, mein Herr. Wie geht's mit Ihnen?
Danke, sehr gut bei Ihnen. Well, we talked before, remember?
Ja, ich habe nicht vergisst.
This is super.
Yes, I remember your phone call on ABN, even though it was... it's a little bit difficult sitting on the set because there's this one speaker back behind the cameras. And there's almost always a delay between when Brother Joseph, says, "You're on the air," and then there's sort of this delay, and eventually the voice comes up. But yes, I remember your phone call. Yes, sir.
There is also at the same time I have the real player on, and I hear this, and it's like 20 seconds later.
Yes. Well, there's always some type of a delay when it comes to the internet. But what can we do for you today?
Okay, I need help, and it might be a little difficult. Okay, I have to tell you first. You got to give me a little time. I try to make it brief. Where I'm coming from, I am PK. My dad is a pastor,
mm-hmm.
and he's in retirement now. So I've been a Christian all my life, and you know, when I was my 20s, strayed around a little bit. But I married my wife. She is a Christian. She's actually from Columbus, Ohio, by the way.
Ah, did she know Eric and Cantor?
I don't know. but funny thing is, she is a gospel singer, and she was in my dad's church when he was still working.
Uh-huh.
And she was one of the lead singers, and she was on a gospel tour in Germany, right? And then I talked to her, and this is how I... So and then we got married like a couple years after that.
Mm-hmm.
And... this is now 8 years ago.
So ah, okay.
Anyways, so and since I'm together with my wife, she kind of brought me closer to God again.
Mm-hmm.
And I never left, but I was didn't pay much attention to the whole thing. However, for some reason, I started to like 2 or 3 years ago be very interested in Islam. Not that I want to convert or so, but what they are doing. I know personally Muslims a lot, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I am the closer you get to those people, they reveal a lot about themselves. And I figured there's something wrong there. So I got into internet and did research, and I stumbled over Wali Chabad. You probably know about him, right?
Yes, I do.
And I was stunned his way at looking at the Bible. So then I looked further, and then I saw... you also on ABN TV and also on YouTube, and how you explain things, and those things are eye openers to me. I never saw such a clear picture of God, if mm-hmm. I can say it that
yeah.
way.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, when Jesus is on the cross and says, "Oh my God, why you have forsaken me?"
Right.
Right? Muslims use this to trap Christians, right?
Right.
And I never paid much attention to it, but now I know he's quoting Psalm 22, and
right.
then when you read it, it makes perfect sense, right?
Right, exactly.
So, and what I need help for is I don't have anyone who I can talk to really about this. I mean, I can talk to my parents, but my dad, they're old, and they have this is a different way of thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they always told me, Israel is crucial. You have to watch out what's happening in Israel, and you have don't go against Jews because those are God's people. He told me that all the time. I've been raised like that. But other than that, I talked to a pastor a couple of days ago, and he said I told him about how Islam is possibly involved in that. And how it all fits together, he was stunned. He didn't know nothing about it.
Hmm. Well, it sounds like I'm not quite sure about the issues regarding Israel and things like that, but it sounds like what you're saying is you don't seem to find in the churches nearby you a whole lot of interest or zeal for sound theology and in-depth theology.
Yeah, exactly. I want to have intelligent conversation with other Christians, share point of views and ask maybe questions and you know, share ideas. And there's guys from Acts 17, for example, right?
Right.
I like what they're doing, but this, yeah, they're on trial right now, and it's really hard to get a hold of them.
Well, yeah, and obviously they have rather pressing things that they have to do as well. So
exactly,
obviously that kind of fellowship is something that you look for in your local area. Now, obviously, I've not even had the privilege yet of traveling in Deutschland. I would love to come. I'd probably at least be able to order my food. I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to be of much assistance as far as directing you to any solid works in Germany, because that's just not something that I'd be familiar with. However, we do have people that listen from around the world, and it's possible that someone might contact us. And I know that there's at least one of the individuals who runs the Answering Islam website is German, and I believe, if I'm correct, that he still lives in Germany. So you might want to contact the webmaster at answeringislam.org. It's answering-islam.org.
Like a minus dash or?
Yes.
Okay. Let me write this down.
Yeah, answering-islam.org. One of the primary people that runs that website is in Germany, and hence probably would be the best person I can think of off the top of my head to direct you toward people that would be theologically sound and especially familiar with issues relating to Islam.
That helps. That information already helped me really a lot.
Yeah, but obviously finding a solid, well-balanced church is difficult enough in the United States. It's far more difficult in the very secularized world of the European Union.
Oh, yeah.
And so a part of what is certainly helpful to some people that I know of in those areas is the internet does provide a large amount of recordings. Certainly sermonaudio.com is a real resource. I was using that this week.
Can you say this again, please?
Yeah, Sermon Audio, SermonAudio.
Okay, English is not my first language.
I understand. Each first day. SermonAudio.com.
Like audio, like sound.
Yes,
right?
Yes. SermonAudio.com.
Okay,
you can find some tremendous ministries there. My own church is there, and there are many other churches, very sound churches, where, you know, it's not the same thing as talking with someone, but you can find some tremendous resources there as far as teaching and in-depth exegesis of the text is concerned. So there, a lot of people do find the internet to be extremely helpful when they find themselves in a situation. A lot of our military men, for example, have contacted me, and they've spent time in Iraq or Afghanistan, and they said their iPod is what kept them sane during that time because there wasn't much else that they could do. But hopefully that local contact there through answering-islam.org can direct you to maybe some churches that you're just not aware of in your area that might be of assistance to you.
I really appreciate it, and I want to share one thing with you and the listeners here, that you know what's going on in Europe. One example was about a year ago, a pastor, not sure, from a local church, he was like, I don't know how it's called in English, but he was like a pastor for several churches in one. We have also states in Germany, like Bavaria and like Berlin, you know, and from an entire state, the head of the church from that entire German state, from the Lutheran church in Germany, he recommended a prayer for Christians and Muslims together.
Mm-hmm.
So he was about to invite Muslim scholars or imams or whomever, and they wanted to make a prayer together, which is That's a no-no. That, you know what I mean?
Well, there's obviously there is a very strong pressure placed upon Christians in Europe to be inclusivistic, to not say that Jesus Christ is the only way, and therefore to water down the gospel and the claims of Christ, and therefore to seek some type of least common denominator between various religions. And that certainly happens amongst the monotheistic religions, the Abrahamic religions, Christianity, right. Islam, and Judaism, where let's just drop our distinctives. Well, the reality is, while liberal Jews might be able to get away with something like that, a believing Muslim and a believing Christian cannot do that. It's just not possible to do that. And so it really is a pressure that to abandon the Christian faith. So I'm well aware that that's what you have there in Germany, and it's even worse in certain of the Scandinavian countries, and
even more liberal. That's true.
Yes, it's amazing.
Well,
so it's
my dad, when he retired, he auditioned other pastors to follow up in his ministry, right? And the one was there, he didn't even believe in Jesus' resurrection as a pastor. Can
right.
you imagine?
No, I can. Unfortunately, I've unfortunately, it is your own land, especially around the area around Tübingen, and the New Testament studies that came out of there in the 1800s, the late 1800s, that has laid the foundation for so much of the decay of Christianity in the West. It really has. So it's a shame, and I unfortunately see this happening in the United States as well, just not nearly as quickly. And if we don't look your direction and see the havoc that it brings, we will merrily march our way right down the same path if we don't learn from the errors of others. So be listening tomorrow night, Peter, for my debate with Abdullah Kunda on ABN.
It's tonight.
Tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night. Yeah, I always watch when the English stuff is on. I don't understand Aramaic, but when the English stuff is on, I usually watch. Yes, I'm checking it out. By the way, I saw some debates from Nabil. You know Nabil, right?
Nabil Qureshi, yes.
Exactly, and he was really winning that debate clearly. And a Muslim is on YouTube, Muslim by choice, put it on. And he thought he was winning.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes.
But he didn't. Are they blinded or something?
Yes, yes, very much so. It is amazing how often individuals will think that they performed wonderfully well. It certainly would not surprise me at all if the fellow you were talking about is Osama Abdullah, because Osama
Farhan is his name.
Farhan Qureshi. Yeah,
Farhan. Yeah, same name like
yes.
Nabil.
Yeah, yeah. Farhan. Now Farhan's a different type of fellow. But yeah, Farhan. I've debated Farhan and probably will again in the future. He's one of the guys I respect. But there
he's
is
nice though. Yes, true.
Yes, he is. There is a blindness. Well, Abdullah Kunda, my opponent tomorrow evening is one that I respect as well. So, but some of them like Osama Abdullah absolutely implode but always think that they won. Nader Ahmed is another one like that. So yes, there is a level of blindness there that is without question. Hey, Peter, we got a bunch of other folks calling in.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to hold.
Oh, no, no problem at all.
And, by the way, why did you learn German that well?
Ich habe 3 Jahre auf Deutsch gelernt im Hochschule und in der Universität.
So thank you very much,
well.
Sir.
Okay, thank you, and God bless you, and thanks for all the information. It really helped me.
Guten Tag.
Tschüssi, bis dann.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. What's wrong? What are you laughing at? Nothing, go on. Okay. All right, let's get to the folks who've been waiting longest here, and let's talk with Kyle. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, Dr. White.
Guten Tag, Kyle.
I have no idea how to speak German.
Das ist aber schade.
Hola. I have a question. I don't want you to get too deep into it if you don't want. On Romans 7, I had a fairly well-known Reformed theologian, he said that we need to keep in mind that Romans was written to a congregate or to where the congregation would have had it read to him all at once.
Okay.
And he kind of used this as a way to basically say if you're reading too far into it, that may not be your kind of going overboard on what Paul may have meant, because you know it would have been heard all at once, and the detail of these really thick commentaries would, you know, Paul would kind of chuckle at, because you know.
Well,
is that a valid?
No, I don't think that it is. Now there certainly is a method of interpretation that becomes so obtuse and so picayune, I suppose would be the term, that I could at least understand some criticisms of where some scholars go. Some scholars get so deep into the woods that they couldn't find their way back out with a compass, but
yeah,
or a GPS device. But real meaningful critical commentaries are seeking to get to that very level of understanding of what someone would have understood had they been in the original audience that was hearing that epistle for the first time. And so all they're doing, the in-depth material that you find in, for example, Douglas Moo's commentary on Romans or Murray's commentary on Romans, two of the best that you can get, is certainly, obviously, a huge 500-page volume is much more than the original papyri letter that was delivered to the Romans. But why is that there? Because we're living 2,000 years later, and we're living in a different culture, and we're living speaking a different language. And so all that extra stuff is meant to put us back in the position of understanding what was originally spoken. And that not only is talking about the language and the relationship, but it's also talking about putting Romans in the context of the rest of Paul's letters, which is a perfectly valid thing to do, because in some situations anyways, not in the letter to the Romans, but in a secondary sense, Paul had taught many of these congregations things orally, and at least the people at Rome would have been taught by people that Paul himself had taught, or had been the church that had been founded by people that he himself had been trained. And so we're missing some of the context they would have had. And so the commentary is seeking to consistently place Paul's words within the rest of what he said, which having someone, you know, coming along who knows Paul back then would have provided the same type of thing. It's seeking to address the language issues, the proper translation issues, the context issues. That's why a commentary that's a good commentary like that is going to be as big as it is. Is it seeking to fill in those particular aspects? And so I don't think it's valid to say, well, you know, it was only, you know, a certain number of papyri sheets long when it was first delivered. Why do you need something that's 500 pages now? Well, because we have a lot of questions about what would have been originally written. Some questions that are asked in commentaries are beyond the scope of what the author was originally intending to communicate. That may be quite true. But the vast majority of the good commentaries, you know, I'm using very much as I'm preaching through Hebrews, F.F. Bruce, Hughes, O'Brien's new pillar commentary on Hebrews. I'm finding useful material in all of these. To enlighten me as to backgrounds and uses and all sorts of things like that, which distance and time have introduced to the issue. And you have one other thing, and that is we are asking questions now in our context that would not necessarily have been asked then, but still, you know, we need to have answers to. And so I don't think it's valid to just simply say, well, you know, all that stuff is worthless. It's going far beyond what the original writer would have, you know, considered. I think that Paul would have expected his audience to do due diligence to understand what he was saying in the context he was saying it. And good commentaries, that's what they should be doing.
Okay, that helps very much.
Okay.
You mentioned Douglas Moo, would you fall on his side of the line on Romans 7?
What's his? There's a, you know, the big dispute in Romans 7 is this a Christian or a non-Christian speaking here? And I don't remember off the top of my head where Moo came down on that. I'm sorry.
He says that it's a hypothetical old covenant Jew.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't come down on that side.
Okay.
I think the more common view that Paul is describing his own situation there, but anyway, that's a whole
other
issue.
Yeah. Sorry. Okay,
all right,
thanks, Kyle.
All right, God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye.
877-753-3341. Let's talk to Tanner up in Nevada. Hi, Tanner.
Hi, Dr. White. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Sorry to call on a lowly landline, but...
That's okay.
Anyway, I'm a student at the University of Nevada, Reno, and this semester I'm taking a world religions class. The professor is very against Christianity. He speaks out against it on a regular basis, and I actually... somewhat appreciate it because it gives me a bit of a platform to preach the truth of Christianity when I can through asking questions and things like that. But
right.
Something he brought up that I just don't know how to respond to is he claims that early Judaism and Christianity even stole the concept of hell from Zoroaster, the founder of Zoroastrianism. And I have never heard this before,
I
don't know how to respond to it, and I was curious as to what you thought or how you would respond.
Well, it's a common assertion amongst world religion profs who are infected with parallelomania, which is the idea that since there cannot be any divine revelation, then you have to find something other than divine revelation as the source of everything in a religion. And so since there is a greater clarity in the New Covenant scriptures on the nature of the afterlife, but that couldn't have come from revelation. You can't have something like a continuing revelation in the sense of old covenant to new covenant and anything like that. You can't have fulfillment of prophecies and all the rest of that stuff. Then you have to look around and everyone becomes borrowers from everything else. Now, the fact that both Jews and Christians detested paganism and hence would detest Zoroastrianism or the Eastern religions and their polytheism and their views of cosmology and things like that. That's irrelevant. You can ignore that part. They'll go ahead and borrow wholesale from people they find reprehensible if they can just fit it in, because it's the only way that you can explain where these things came from because of your overriding presupposition there's no such thing as divine revelation. So it's a circular thing. It's what they've been taught. Very rarely have they ever been challenged on a fundamental basis to even think about this type of a thing. It sounds like your professor is very much like my daughter's professor at Glendale Community College. When you do challenge them, their response is an acerbic, condescending, you just must be a stupid fundamentalist type thing. But they will never, ever, ever examine their presuppositions or anything like that. They just won't even go there. So the response would be to point out the shadows of the greater fulfillment that's found in the New Testament in regards to Jesus' constant and repetitious teaching on the subject of hell that we can find in books like Isaiah. You get toward the end of the Old Testament and more light is being shed on the afterlife and the nature of Sheol and the shades that are in Sheol and issues like that. There's discussion of this in Robert Morey's book, Death and the Afterlife, that you might want to take a look at. But the whole thing devolves down to why would anyone think that Jesus, who taught more about hell and the eternal punishment than anybody else in the New Testament, or throw in the Apostle Paul for the two people who spoke the most about it, given that nothing else in their teachings or their theology shows any connection whatsoever with Zoroastrianism, why would you think that that's the one thing that they quote-unquote borrowed? What's your evidence they had any connection, any contact with it? All these things. It really starts falling apart. And another book you might want to look at to prepare you for all of the parallelomania that you'll be encountering from this guy is Ronald Nash's book, The Gospel. It's either Christ Amongst the Greeks or The Gospel in the Greeks. The title's going off the top of my head right now. Maybe someone will throw it up in the channel here in a moment. But just look up Nash and The Gospel in the Greeks, I think, is the title of the book. And I think you'll find that to be extremely helpful. Anybody going to a secular university needs to read that and be familiar with it. The Gospel in the Greeks does seem to be the... I've gotten that three times now in the channel. The Gospel in the Greeks by Nash will be very helpful to you.
Okay, great. And then, so would you say that this the revelation of hell is much like the Trinity as far as kind of the progressive revelation of it and more revealed in the Bible. I've heard you quote B.B. Warfield on the Trinity and things like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, it's not the focus of discussion in obviously, what we're referring to here is progressive revelation, that there are things that are laid out since certain things are related to other things. As you get more in-depth revelation regards to the nature of man and God's purposes in salvation, then you get more revelation regards to the nature of the afterlife. And there's certainly much more in the New Testament than there is in the Old Testament at that point. But again, since they're functioning on the idea that there can't be anything like progressive revelation, God wouldn't have a purpose for anything like this, they just default into the, well, it just must be something to do with borrowing from one religion to another.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay,
all right. Real quick, have you done a debate on this subject, or is there one coming up that I can look for?
Not on Zoroastrianism and hell, no.
The parallelomania and the things like that you were discussing.
Yeah. Well, some of it. The debate with Dan Barker last year, October, up in Oregon, was very much on parallelomania. And I did an unbelievable radio program with the Foresters on the subject of hell. So those would be the two that would be the closest.
Thank you so much for the research, and I will pick those books up. Thank you.
Thanks, Tanner. God bless.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
All righty. Helping folks along here. And it looks to me that I'll just go with the person who's been online longest, Daniel. Hi, Daniel. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
What's up, sir?
I had a question about sexual
variance. Wow, your phone line's really, really, really bad. Are you outside, or is there...
No, this is weird.
Whatever you're doing, it sounded better, but it sounded like you had a bunch of shorts in the line. So if you're standing on one foot with one foot raised in the air right now, stay in that position, because we can hear you.
I'll try.
Okay.
I had a question about 2 Peter 1:21, just at the end of the verse. I was looking, the Textus Receptus says, hoi agioi theou anthropoi, and I was looking at the Westcott and Hort, and it says, apo theou anthropoi, and I'm just curious about the...
Now, what's the reference there?
2 Peter 1:21.
Well, it would help if I had the right reference on the screen. I had it all queued up, and to 1 Peter 1:21, unfortunately, so I'm going to try to get over to 2 Peter here as quickly as possible. Okay, and there's a couple different variants here toward the end. And what was your actually, this is the same text that I discussed with Dan Wallace when he was on the program last year.
Okay.
The difference you have, the very, very important variant. I think it's very important that it reads pharamenoi lalesen apa theou anthropoi, and that be translated, men spoke from God as they're carried along by the Holy Spirit. You're correct that the variant, what it does is say holy men spoke as they were carried along, and you lose the origin of their speaking being apa theou, and instead you have an emphasis upon the holiness of those men. And I think that is has some fairly major theological significance to it. But you will notice that the text in the Nestle-Aulin text is witnessed by P72, Vaticanus, and numerous others. So it has a very, very early basis to it at that point.
Gotcha.
And there was a discussion. The specific dividing line you'd want to listen to on that. And I'm sorry?
I think I have that one. On my...
Yeah, it's August 6th of 2009. Yeah. And I think I apologized later. Poor Dan was not feeling well that day, but he still was on with me. And he had sent me an email that came in right before the program, and hence I did not see it because I don't do the program in my office. And he had specifically said, oh, let's not go for those. Let's go for these. Well, I hadn't gotten it. And so I just went with the ones that we had it's written before. He still handled it pretty well. So I appreciate Dan's patience. But you'll hear our discussion of that on that August 6th one.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks, Dan.
Have a good one.
All right. Bye-bye. I think we're going to make it all the way through here because we have only one call left. And let's talk with Walt in Michigan. Hi, Walt.
Hello, Dr. White. Good evening.
Good evening.
Question for you, sir. Just a little bit of background. I was at the God and Culture Conference that you spoke at in Waterford, Michigan last month. Mm-hmm. One of the things you did was a presentation on the basics of Islam.
Right.
And you would ask the people in the sanctuary who were attending, show of hands, how many of you have read the Quran?
Yeah.
And I think one hand went up.
That's
it
true.
Wasn't mine. And what I wanted to do was, in a sense, take you up on the challenge. And you had also mentioned that you had had an entry on the Alpha and Omega website concerning a chronological order of the
right.
surahs, and
mm-hmm.
you recommended reading them in those orders.
Were you able to find that?
I was, yes.
Okay, good.
So I was able to find that. I have started, and I'm probably about a good fifth of the way through the Quran right now.
So you're still in the Meccan surahs right now?
Yes. And one of the things I've noticed is that there is what appears to be, assuming that this is the voice of Allah, that it's the plural as opposed to a singular.
Yeah.
For example, in Surah 95 in Ayah 4, the translation I have says, that of goodliest fabric we created man.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my understanding from Islamic theology is that Allah is solitary, monolithic, not a trinity.
Right.
What's the understanding of a plural usage here? I mean, it wasn't just only in this surah, it was several others that I noticed, and I was just trying to reconcile
right.
what I'm reading here with my what I've heard of Islamic theology about Allah.
Right, right. The vast majority of Islamic scholars and apologists and readers are going to identify the use of the plural in reference to Allah as the plural of majesty.
Okay.
The royal we, similar to, ironically, even the papacy frequently uses the royal we as well. We define this and we define that. And so generally the understanding is that this is a manner of a majestic plural, the God speaking, even though there are, of course, places where the singular is used when in reference to Allah maybe acting a certain way, something like that. But still, the majestic plural is probably the most often repeated explanation for why you have that form in the Quran. I don't see any basis for seeing anything more in it than that because it does seem to be well-established usage in Semitic languages by that time period. So I know that there are some who dispute a very ancient appearance of a majestic plural in regards to Hebrew, but there's no question that by the medieval period, and I would view the Quran as an early medieval work, the plural of majesty was well established, and you can provide lots of examples of it in related languages.
I appreciate your background on that. Thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate you taking up the challenge and working through the text. Keep in mind the fact that you are in the portion of the Quran right now that, and again, that. Chronological order is not perfect, especially because some of the surah are mixed surahs. In other words, there's material in one surah from both the Medinan and Meccan periods, and so it's not perfect, but it's a whole lot better than just starting at the Surah Al-Fatiha and then reading straight through, which is Surah 1. So, but keep in mind, right now what you're reading is Muhammad. In the early period, Muhammad as a persecuted minority prophet, Muhammad emphasizing monotheism in a polytheistic culture. But you're going to start seeing development, and especially after the Hijra, and you have now he's in Medina, and he begins very quickly to be a political leader with political power, I think you'll see not only the change in tone, but then there really comes a point where you can tell that the author realizes, I've tried to get the Jews and the Christians to come over to my side. I've tried to get them to sort of be on the page with me. It ain't going to happen. Therefore, this is how we need to start dealing with them. And you'll see that shift. But that's gonna take you, into the early part, really sort of the middle part of the Medinan surahs. And you're talking approximately 2/3 is Meccan and 1/3 is Medinan. So you still got a ways to go. But some of those Medinan surahs are much longer too. So press forward. And what translation do you have? Do you have a Yusuf Ali?
I'm looking at Penguin's Classic Dawood.
Oh, okay. All right. Are there any study notes or anything with it?
There are some accompanying footnotes and the like. I think, if I remember correctly, there's just a little bit of background that's there in the front, but it's not.
Yeah.
Really, it's not really extensive. It's more the sense of if something's obscure, one or two words. Dawood will elaborate, but beyond that, not really too much more commentary.
Well, if you run into stuff that just really leaves you utterly befuddled, there are a number of websites. I have about six of them. Actually, I got about a dozen of them in my bookmarks, where you can, like Quran. I think QuranBrowser.com is one of them, where you can get multiple translations, and so it's just as useful in comparing NKJV, ESV, NASB, NIV. It's just as useful to compare a number of translations with some texts that just seem really obscure in the translation that you're using. The Halali Khan translation is often very useful along those lines too. So those are all available online as well. All righty?
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Walt.
Bye.
All right, God bless. Bye-bye. All right, well, excellent, excellent, excellent questions from all around the world today once again. Well, okay, one from Germany, but it's a long ways away. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning his time. I should have said guten Morgen to him, not guten Abend or guten Tag or guten Nacht. Actually, it's guten Tag here, but not where he is. But excellent questions on a wide variety of subjects there. That's why we like doing the Dividing Line, and the few of you who listen are like listening as well. It is amazing where this program goes. But Lord willing, next Tuesday we'll be back here on the program. And please be praying for the debate tomorrow evening. My hope is it will be similar to the debate I had with Abdullah Kunda at the University of Sydney last August, over a year ago now, where there was a very clear, I think, testimony given to the gospel and the fact that the gospel is light and guidance. That whole debate, if you'd like to sort of get revved up for tomorrow evening, that entire debate I posted from Australia, and it is on YouTube. So you can watch it there and sort of get your mind set up for tomorrow evening, 8 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, absat.com. If you don't have the satellite connection, get online. My debate with Abdullah Kunda. Be praying for that. We'll see you next week. God bless.
Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org.
where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.